We have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I know we promised the listeners last week that Maria would be back this week, but she...
We lied.
She's ill after her extended heavy-duty work schedule for the last couple weeks. That took it out of her.
So. Yeah, it did.
So we're fingers crossed that she will be back next week.
Yes.
And we're going to be getting to election information and analysis here soon. But so we'll be going over that this week in an extended, since the ballots are just out this week, we'll be going over that this week. And then next week, again, fingers crossed that she's back. She'll be able to give us her take on things then.
Sounds great.
Does that sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, so we're going to get to that in just a sec. There was a couple items that I wanted to cover real quick.
We very rarely have a plan. I mean, I want to mark that for the listeners.
Yeah, we should. Everybody mark your calendars. This is the first and only time this will ever happen, we promise. All right. So earlier this week, Lester Black with The Stranger wrote about event with the regarding the city's Office of Professional Accountability,
yes,
that it has cleared an SPD cop of any wrongdoing in the New Year's Eve killing of Ayosha Falatago in North Seattle. And quoting here from the article, Falatago was pinned to the ground by multiple officers when one cop killed Falatago with one shot fired at point-blank range. Corey Gilmet, an attorney for Falatago's family, said the shooting could have been prevented. Quote, officers outnumbered Mr. Falatago 6-1 and forced him onto his hands and knees, Gilmet said in a statement. After he was forced to the ground, an officer announced that Mr. Falatago dropped the gun. Once he complied with commands by dropping the gun, officers could have safely resolved the situation by picking up the gun. The city's, now not quoting, but reading from the article, the city's OPA disagreed, finding that Officer Jared Keller, who killed Falatago, had no other safe option but to shoot and kill the 39-year-old because the officers saw a handgun on Falatago and knew it was, quote, within the subject's immediate reach, end quote. The OPA said officers are not trained to use, quote, less lethal options like a taser during these situations. Instead, they are trained to have one officer attempt to control the suspect's hands while another officer, quote, is taught to place his firearm against the individual's head to prepare to fire a contact shot, end quote.
And I'm going to make a couple points about that. Mm-hmm. One is that the OPA does not have independent ability to get evidence. They are totally reliant on reviewing the evidence from the SPD's internal investigation. So they're limited that way in what they can review. That's been a problem that police reform activists have been complaining about for years. The other thing I would say is that maybe I missed it, but I did not see anything about that in the Seattle Times. And it really underscores how few media outlets we have in this city right now that report on local doings. We have The Stranger, which is hit and miss in terms of picking things up, mm-hmm, although I'm very glad they ran that article. And we have the Seattle Times, which has its own agenda. And that's about it. There are a few bloggers and independent reporters that
try
and pick up.
We have Crosscut, too.
We have Crosscut, yeah.
Fairly solid on
things. They pick up some things, but again, they're hit and miss. They don't cover everything.
Sure.
They're not a paper of record, which is what the Seattle Times reports to be. And Erica Barnett also does excellent information, but
yes,
she can only do so much. She's one person. And there are other bloggers like that that are trying to fill in the gaps, but they find a story here and there, but they can't comprehensively review what's going on with the city. The city's an enormous bureaucracy. And that's just the city of Seattle. There's obviously plenty of other agencies that can be in the news. So we really need independent media. We need more reporters out there, scouring public records and paying attention to this stuff,
yeah,
going to meetings and all that kind of thing. It's a real dearth in this city for a city this size to not have more reporters covering this sort of stuff.
one of the shows we aired during the week had talked about how Tom Steyer, who I believe is spending like $100 million of his own money going around the country for the presidential race, if only he had like invested that in local independent media resources across the country, it would have totally changed things far more, 1,000 times more than his candidacy.
And yeah, and you know, this is something the Democrats have been weak on for decades. The Republicans understood basically dating from the 80s the value of investing in their own media networks. And we now have, you know, a solid third of the country that believes whatever the Republicans have to say, which is often not particularly tethered to reality. So, but the Democrats have done a very poor job of countering that. And it's really showed.
And then the other item I had, and speaking of Crosscut, and a side note, I just saw last night that Marcus Harrison Green got picked up by Crosscut, so he's going to be a regular writer there.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
Founder of the Emerald, South Seattle Emerald, now getting picked up, formerly at the Seattle Times and now at Crosscut.
Yeah, I've been meaning to give him a call to find out what happened to his tenure at the Seattle Times.
I think we'd all like to know the real story.
He was, yeah, he was not there for very long, and he was very optimistic when he came in that he could make a difference.
Yeah.
That's why he left the Emerald, which was his baby, and which he did an amazing job of, turning into an ongoing enterprise. And he's very much missed there, but I hope he does good work at Crosscut. He's a great reporter.
Definitely. So Lily Fowler, reporting for Crosscut on the 16th, says that county prosecutors in Washington are facilitating the arrests of undocumented immigrants at courthouses by sharing schedules with federal immigration officials. Correspondence obtained by the University of Washington Center revealed Wednesday. Emails obtained by the University of Washington Center for Human Rights, which just does amazing work, that's my editorial there, through public records requests show one key avenue which some have long suspected, that prosecutors are collaborating with ICE and Border Patrol. Legislation Governor Jay Inslee signed into law earlier this year prohibits local law enforcement from working with federal officers for immigration purposes, and immigrant rights advocates have petitioned the state Supreme Court to put a stop to both courthouse arrests and prosecutors' collaboration with immigration officials. And that was, at least from their records, they found multiple instances of that in Grant and Adams County, which is, I believe, the east side of the Spokane area,
yes,
East side of the state.
Yeah, Grant County is Moses Lake, and Adams County is Ritzville, which is a very rural area.
So,
but both have large Hispanic populations.
Yes. I wanted to pass that on. Meanwhile, excuse me, on this side of the mountains, our favorite local entity, Amazon, apparently found one of those pallets full of money that was in Iraq and brought it to
not
the
not really doing anything, buried in the spheres, yeah.
So,
yeah, they dumped well over $1 million into the local city council raises, which is, of course, in independent expenditures funneled through the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce's PAC, which is already had already raised well over $1 million for races that it is targeting, particularly in city council, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Which candidates they're targeting, and which candidates they're supporting. But the city council elections, with all the districts up for election this year, is really a referendum between who you want running the city, because 6 of the 7 races have candidates that are supported by the chamber's money, which is to say Amazon's money, and but also other major donors like Comcast and AT&T and Boeing and Weyerhaeuser, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It really underscores that this race is a referendum for whether Amazon's going to control city council, or whether progressive grassroots activists are going to have a say in how the city is run going forward. It is really a critical election, and people should have gotten their ballots yesterday or today in the mail. Get your ballots in early. They're due by November 5th, which is a Tuesday, of course. And We'll go over the
our analysis
of it, and then as you said, next week Mary can weigh in with her analysis.
Excellent. Yes, and in addition to us encouraging you to vote in whichever way you see fit, it's also incredibly important to help others vote this time around.
Yeah, particularly if the candidates you're supporting don't have large independent expenditures helping them, because a lot of those independent expenditures, they don't just go for direct mail at this point. They go for hiring canvassers who can go door to door or making phone calls and getting out the vote for their candidates. So so really getting out the vote for those candidates who are not supported by that kind of infrastructure, if you're supporting those candidates, is really important. And of course, you can volunteer also, and they can always use money, and they can always use volunteers. And there's plenty of time still.
And I believe I saw this week, again sticking on the Amazon and the PACs, that just prior to the news that Amazon had dropped just over an additional $1 million into this race, that Case has basically,
which is Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce's PAC,
and this is why we're going to get you on a game show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ding.
They had spent $300,000 just recently. Four people canvassing, knocking on doors and stuff, basically paying locals and outsiders $20 an hour to go knock on others' doors. And if you're there, talk to them for a minute and drop off a little flyer. So,
I heard an anecdote that somebody who was canvassing on behalf of Egan O'Ryan in District 3 told the person he was canvassing that, well, personally, he's voting for Sharma, but this is what he's getting paid to do. So these are people who may or may not be local, and if they're local, they may or may not be invested in the candidate that they're canvassing for.
But it did raise the question, too, of the, again, sticking with the Amazon $1 million, it does raise the question of specifically what that money's going to go for, because most of the ad spots have already been bought up for television.
Yes.
So what do you think that $1 million is going to be spent on?
Primarily people, primarily paid canvassers, paid phone makers to get out the vote. That's the most important thing for these folks now.
Okay.
For any of these candidates.
All right. Well, moving on to the actual candidates and the races, we talked about several different categories last week, but since Maria isn't here this week, we're going to, and since ballots have officially arrived, we're going to go over the entire slate.
Let's review those. I also posted my personal recommendations on Facebook last night for anybody who's interested in that, Jav Parrish. Let's go through these. First of all, the ballot measures. Referendum 88 is a state ballot measure that would re-legalize affirmative action, which was banned in the late 90s. I think it was a John Carlson initiative. This measure is fairly narrowly crafted. It would allow affirmative action for state agencies, nobody else, as one factor among many. And in the language of the referendum, it explicitly says that racial quotas are banned, but you can take race or ethnicity, religion or sexual orientation, et cetera, if that's what you feel that as a somebody who's hiring, for example, if that's what you feel you're missing, you can take that into account as one factor among many. You can't solely base your decision upon that. But you can take it into account. I think this is long overdue. We've seen a lot of statistics that say that state agencies have become much less diverse over the last 20 years or so, that these kind of decisions have been prohibited by state law. So this would overturn that prohibition. And personally, I think it's a good idea. But, check it out and make up your own mind.
All right. Initiative, 976.
Yeah, that's another state measure. This is from Tim Eyman, our good friend up in Snohomish County. It's another $30 car tab, but it is specifically aimed at defunding transportation. That is to say that the lost revenue from the reduced car tab fees would hit a lot of agencies. For example, this measure would also specifically prohibit Sound Transit from having an independent taxing authority, which it now has. And the estimation is that it would, or the estimate is that it would lose some $20 billion, as B as in billion, of funding. That would really cripple the effort to build out the light rail lines that it's currently doing. The state government would lose some $2.3 billion in revenue. Local governments would lose $3.9 billion. It would result in a cut of 170,000 hours of bus service in Seattle. So if you've taken buses recently and know how crowded they are, especially during daytime hours, that would be a significant reduction in existing service and result in much more crowded buses, I think. And, of course, the city and county have been really trying to, through their policies, encourage people to get out of their cars and take public transit. This would make taking public transit in all forms much more difficult. It would make the enormous backlog of road maintenance, roads and bridges, far worse. And the $30 tabs means it's extremely regressive because it's $30 car tabs for, say, a luxury $60,000 vehicle, as well as your $1,000 beater that's 30 years old. So it's regressive in that sense as well. But if you take public transit, this is a bad idea. So, enough said.
All right, thanks. And advisory votes.
Yeah, there are 12 of them this year. This is why King County's ballot is of record length this year. This, again, is a result of a previous Tim Iman initiative that required non-binding advisory votes anytime the state legislature raises a tax or a fee. And so the public is asked to weigh in as to whether they think this is a good idea, maintain it or reject it. That doesn't force the state legislature to actually do anything. So it's kind of an enormous waste of time and money because the state legislature has not reversed itself at all on any of these measures in the years and years that this initiative has been in effect. It almost doesn't matter what these 12 votes are on. It's kind of a waste of time, honestly.
Okay. Senate Joint Resolution 8200.
That's changes in the boilerplate language on the definition of what constitutes an emergency in the case of a local natural disasters, particularly earthquakes, which Seattle is overdue for. that would clarify when local governments can declare a state of emergency, which not only affects the public, but it also affects eligibility for federal and state funding to help with the coping with the emergency. So this is fairly straightforward. It's not anything controversial. Nobody's really opposing it. So that's what that is.
So voting yes on it allows the different local entities to declare these emergencies.
Well,
did I just make it more confusing?
You did, because it allows them to declare the emergency once certain conditions are met,
gotcha.
And that's what the language is for.
All right. King County Proposition 1.
Yeah, this is the Medic 1 levy. Do you like life-saving public service? If you have a stroke or a heart attack or something where you need to get to a hospital fast, that's what this is for. So, if you think that service is valuable, you should pay for it.
Gotcha. So that's when uniformed representatives of our local municipality show up in one of our vehicles, one of our public vehicles.
Yes, that's Medic 1, which is the county. AMR has the contract for the city.
Gotcha. So I was making a brief play on an old joke of how Eat the State used to be delivered by federal uniformed
yes.
employees.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so on to elected offices, and starting with the King County Director of Elections.
Yeah, this became an elected office, I believe, 8 years ago, when Republicans, in the wake of the very close gubernatorial race between Rossi and Gregoire, decided that public accountability for Director of Elections was a good idea, and they were hoping to stack that office with Republicans, which has not happened. The incumbent now is Julie Wise, who has a long history of expertise in how you manage elections. She's done a really good job in the last 4 years of expanding access to ballots and, you know, more drop boxes, easier registration. And, of course, the state made it much easier this past year with same-day registration and all the rest of that. If you haven't registered to vote or you need to change your address, at this point, up until Election Day, you can go down in person to the King County Courthouse on 3rd and James or whatever it is, and make that change, and you will be eligible to vote, which is an awesome reform and will hopefully help a lot more people vote.
So people can still, if you have friends that aren't registered, they can still register.
Absolutely. And that's also something that those paid canvassers are probably encouraging people to do. And volunteer canvassers as well, because it's a priority for all of the candidates to try and get out as many votes as they can. But on this particular race, Julie Wise is the incumbent. She's done a really good job. And personally, I think she deserves another 4 years. Her opponent is not particularly qualified.
All right, moving on to King County Council District 2.
Yeah, this is a difficult race for a lot of progressives. Larry Gossett has been there basically since pterodactyls roamed the earth. He is a local civil rights icon who has done an enormous amount of good over the years on the King County Council. He is being challenged by Jermay Zahale. Zahale won 60% of the vote. A lot of people in District 2 are seeming to think that Larry Gossett has been wonderful, but it's time for him to retire. Zahale is a lot younger, a lot more energetic, and just as progressive. So that's the dynamic in that race.
All right. And District 4, also up?
Yeah. Incumbent Jeannie Cole Wells has been a solid liberal presence during her first 4 years. She's now the president of King County Council. Before that, she was in state legislature for many years, representing the part of Seattle, Ballard and that area, Magnolia, et cetera. She's been good on the county council. She will probably be there for another 4 years. Her opponent, again, is not particularly notable for experience or perspectives.
All right. Position 6 still on King County Council.
Yeah, position 6 and position 8 are a little more difficult. In position 6, former Bellevue Mayor Claudia Balducci is the incumbent, and she's been a mixed bag at best. But her opponent is Bill Hurt, who ran for the state legislature last year on the one-note platform of preventing light rail on the east side so as to prevent all those icky people from Seattle from getting to the east side. Maybe he hasn't noticed, but all those icky-looking people live on the east side now, too, and might need to get somewhere by light rail. He really doesn't have any other issues, and is kind of a zealot on preventing light rail from the east side. So Balducci is, as I say, a mixed bag, but I think she's probably far more qualified to continue on council than Hurt is to replace her.
All right. And then District 8.
Same kind of thing. Joe McDermott is a mixed bag at best. He has he's a Democrat and votes that way on council, but he's also very mainstream, very corporatist, and has disappointed on a number of occasions. On the other hand, his opponent is a guy named Michael Neber, who is affiliated with the hate group Save Seattle, and that alone should disqualify him from any public office. So McDermott in that race is probably the better bet.
Okay, moving on to the Port of Seattle, which, as we have pointed out in the past, also is sometimes known as the Pork of Seattle.
They along with the school district are just notoriously corrupt. In the case of the Port of Seattle, it has a long history of people on the Port Commission who are affiliated with corporations that contract with the port. Probably shouldn't be allowed, but it is. However, that's not really the case in these two races. Position number 2, Sam Cho is a former Bob Hasagawa aide. Hasegawa, of course, was a progressive voice in the state legislature for many years. I think he's more qualified and more likely to be a positive presence on the Port Commission than his opponent.
All right. And of course, Bob Hasegawa, who's been battling to bring a state bank to Washington. We'll see if this is the year.
Yes, which California just approved. So hopefully that's some momentum to get Washington State to look at that seriously as well.
All right. Which has nothing to do with the Port of Seattle, but
I'd
throw that in. Position 5. The other port position that's up.
Yeah, there you have the incumbent, Fred Fellman, who was elected in somewhat of a surprise 4 years ago. He's a longtime environmental activist who is extremely knowledgeable about, water pollution and a lot of things that the port actually has a active say in. He's very focused on climate change and its impacts and trying to reduce the air traffic in the port, which also has jurisdiction over SeaTac Airport. He's done a really, really good job on the Port Commission, and somewhat surprisingly, situated himself as a voice for concern on those kind of issues on the Port Commission, which is really invaluable. His opponent is another one of those folks who has close ties to Port of Seattle contractors. So I think Fellman is the better qualified candidate there.
All right. Now moving on to what we held off on last week.
The big show.
Yeah, the real battles here, and where all the different PACs are each backing their dump trucks full of money into and piling away. So
yeah, let's start in with the Seattle City Council. And as I say, many of these races are referendums between the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce and Amazon-backed candidate on the one hand and a grassroots activist on the other. That's certainly the case in District 1. Lisa Herbold has been a solid, if wonkish, progressive voice on the council for the last 4 years. Her office has really set a new standard for constituent service. That is something that the backers of the district initiative a few years ago were hoping would happen, that these districts would get their own identities and demand of constituents more accountability than was possible in the previous system, where if you had a gripe and needed to go with city council to it, you had to figure out which committee was most relevant and then go to the chair of that committee, who may or may not care about what you have to say, and you don't have any other alternatives. Now you have somebody who represents your district, and Herbold has done a very good job of representing West Seattle. Her opponent, Phil Tavel, is another Amazon-backed candidate. He has said, among other things, that homeless people are lazy, which is a right-wing talking point that is not true. Try spending any time living on the street, and you will see that it is not true. And how difficult it is and how much work it takes to even navigate the social service system, let alone get off the street, let alone, find work if you don't have it. And the other myth that ignores is that a lot of homeless people do have jobs. Some of them have a couple of jobs. They just don't have enough money to afford rent in Seattle, which is a huge problem, housing affordability. Tavel mentioned that there is no housing affordability crisis. Well, if you're comfortably upper class, no, there's not. But if you are trying to work on a minimum wage income for a living, it's a huge problem. So I think Herbold is much more tethered to reality on a lot of those issues.
Wow. Maybe he should check out the report that the Chamber of Commerce paid for, the McKinstry report about.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe they ought to send him a copy on that, because I think even they recognize that housing is an issue.
Yes.
All right.
District 2. Yes. Tammy Morales won over 50% of the vote in the primary. She is progressive. She has had the early endorsement of Representative Pramila Jayapal, who she's close to. And her opponent is an SPD analyst named Mark Solomon, who, again, is getting a lot of independent expenditures. Morales, Herbolt, and Shama Sawan in District 3 are really the three candidates that the chamber is working very hard to not get elected. I think Morales would be a better voice on council for the issues that people who are don't have a six-figure income care about.
All right. On to District 3.
Yeah. How should I start on District 3? You know, in football, and yes, the Huskies are playing right now, a cliche is that you don't fire your coach unless you have a better alternative or two or three of them lined up. And the problem with Egan Orion, who is running to try and unseat incumbent Shama Sawant, is that the more you find out about him, the worse he seems. He comes off as smug, bigoted, and wholly dishonest, and really not cognizant of a lot of the issues facing lower-income people in his district. He's been insisting throughout his campaign that he hasn't taken any corporate money, which may be true of his own campaign, but the independent expenditures, he's received more Amazon money than any other candidate in these elections. So I think he's being pretty disingenuous and counting on people to not understand the difference between independent expenditures and individual campaigns. Sawant has been, if nothing, very transparent and very consistent in her priorities in her 6 years on city council. I think she's struggled a little bit with the district system. She is the last person who was originally elected citywide who is still on city council and not running for re-election. But she has been very good in representing constituents who are getting gentrified out of their homes or businesses, small businesses, renters, et cetera. She was almost single-handedly responsible for Seattle adopting a $15 an hour minimum wage, and she's made a huge difference in terms of budget priorities during the budgeting process these last few years. And I believe she's got a people's budget, which is something she does annually during the budget process, of having an open forum where people can come and weigh in on what their budget priorities are. She's been very accountable in that way, and she's been an invaluable voice on a city council that is at risk of becoming increasingly corporatized with all the money flooding into local political elections. With the political landscape and the changing demographics of Seattle, she's a voice that really needs to be heard, I think. So I would love to see her get another 4 years, personally.
And she's been the lightning rod, really, in national money coming in, like from Amazon. And she was their poster child for the person putting up, again, pushing forward the head tax.
And Jim Pugel in District 7 has a independent mailer out that is bashing her as well. If you don't want somebody like Sawant on council, vote for me. That kind of stuff. So she has...
The video for his district as well. It has her image at the beginning of it, even though she's not running in that district.
Yeah, and I think she's she really changes the conversation on city council, and she has been identifiable as having a particular perspective on city council in a way that no other council member has had, in my memory at least, going over the last 30 years. She's been remarkable in her effectiveness for her ability to change and extend the conversation, move the Overton window, as it were. She's an invaluable voice on council, in my opinion.
All right, that takes us on to District 4, which is actually the district right here in the, in the University District as well, the surrounding areas.
Yes, and that pits a former Tim Burgess aide named Alex Peterson, who is getting a fair amount of chamber money, against a Democratic Socialist of America member named Sean Scott, who obviously is not taking corporate money. District 4 is in the midst of a lot of transition. It was the first area outside downtown and South Lake Union to be upzoned. We're seeing the results of that already. The University of Washington, of course, is the 800-pound gorilla in this district. controls a lot of the real estate and is happy to see the upzoning because they will wind up with a lot of those big buildings. And you know, the current upzoning plan is absent the Ave to have the U District look a lot like South Lake Union, which doesn't really do much for the students who want to live in the area, or the teacher's assistants who don't make a particularly good salary, or the tens of thousands of staff people who work at the University of Washington. So it really is a referendum on the future of what that district is going to look like, whether you have a representative who's a bulwark against that kind of gentrification, or whether you have somebody who is all for it and has taken a lot of corporate money and money from UW.
All right, on to District 5.
Oh, District 5, my. I could never imagine over the past couple of years wanting to see Deborah Juarez, who is the incumbent, get reelected. She has been arrogant. She has been a consistent pro-business voice on city council. And she has taken in council sessions to really lecturing and railing at her critics, in particular saying, I can't possibly be a sellout. How dare you? I'm a woman of color. Well, she still votes the way she votes, and that speaks for itself. On the other hand, her opponent is affiliated with Safe Seattle, the hate group, and Davidson Sattler. She also comes out of the neighborhood movement that is opposed to upzoning, which would be a positive, except that she's really bigoted, particularly against the homeless, and ignorant on a lot of issues. So Juarez, for all of her failings, would be a much more qualified member of city council in the next 4 years.
All right. And just two more for the city council districts. Number 6.
Yes. This is a former Bagshaw aide named Dan Strauss, who is actually less reactionary and a bit more progressive, and certainly better informed by her opponent. Her opponent is backed by the Chamber of Commerce once again. It's Heidi Wills, who was on the council in the 90s and lost her seat because of taking money from basically a strip club and then voting to expand a parking lot that strip club wanted expanded. She's really learned nothing from that. She's still taking money from unsavory sources, this being Amazon, which is a little bit bigger than Rick's strip club. So she doesn't seem to have learned a lot from her experience with, taking money from whoever will give it to her and then voting their way. I think Dan Strauss would be a more independent voice on city council and more progressive as well.
And finally, District 7.
Yeah, this is probably the best district in terms of the races, the two candidates being qualified. Former Nikocotta campaign manager named Andrew Lewis, who's both progressive and well-versed in city government. His opponent, Jim Pugel, is well-versed in city government as well. He spent many years with SPD, and including becoming at one point acting chief. He was a voice for reform within SPD, which is why he was kind of forced out and took early retirement, and now he's running for city council. There's two problems with that. One is that Pugel's getting a lot of money from the Chamber of Commerce, and two, he's still very fond of SPD and not likely to force reforms from the city on that behalf.
Although he didn't get endorsed by SPOG.
That's true. I think Andrew Lewis is the more progressive choice there. But it would not be awful to have Pugel on city council, unlike the candidates in many of these other races.
All right, so that just leaves us with the school district and the races there.
Oh yes, yeah. Okay. We talked about the school districts last week, and I think I butchered a couple of the races, which is fine. I make mistakes sometimes. In district number one, Eric Blumhagen is being supported by opponents of chamber schools. They both have histories with the local PTSAs. I think Blumhagen's probably a little bit better bet than Lisa Rankin, who is his opponent, but I think with either of them, it wouldn't be awful.
All right. District 3.
Yes, Chandra Hampson is in District 3. She has a degree in economics from Stanford. That's a skill set that the cash-strapped, administratively bloated school board could desperately use. So I hope to see Chandra Hampson being a positive force on the school board going forward.
And District 6.
Yes, the incumbent and school board president, Leslie Harris, has done reasonably well with an impossible job. The problem with school board members is that they come and go, but the staff of it, of Seattle Public Schools, has all the power. Board members are dependent on them for information. They are frequently fed incorrect or misleading information that protects the bureaucracy and that administrative bloat I mentioned. So it's a hard job to do. On the other hand, Harris has been somewhat disappointing in things like charter schools and corporate influence in Seattle Public Schools, which, given the school district's budget shortfalls, they are very tempted to look to for additional funding. Harris is, I don't think her opponent is particularly well qualified, so I still think that Harris would be the better presence on school board, but she is definitely a mixed bag.
Similar to, you might have touched on this at the beginning with the Port of Seattle, where it has a heavy staff that tends to represent interests that are business interests that are tangential to the port. So at city council level, they have paid, all the council members have paid assistance that help them.
Legislative aid.
Do they have that at the school board and or the at the port?
They do not at the school board. I'm pretty sure the port doesn't either. They're both considered part-time jobs, which is kind of insane given the budgets of the agencies that they're overseeing. It's nearly impossible with that size of an agency to do a competent job and call it a part-time job, but that is the situation. And I think that the paid staff and the paid leadership of both the school board and the port like it that way because it reduces the influence of the commission of the board and their ability to interfere with any corruption or graft that's going on, which particularly in the case of the port, there's a long history of.
And at the state level, our state legislators, sorry to keep going on this, but our state legislators that are only there kind of part-time for a matter of months, depending on which year, every other year, it changes. But they have paid staff.
They have paid staff. They also tend to have day jobs because it's considered a part-time job. And those day jobs frequently are conflicts of interest with the state because they're with companies or agencies that have contracts with the state. And that seems to be okay with the state. They like it that way. You know, the thing with the state legislators is the state constitution was written in the 19th century. It was for a largely agrarian, largely rural new state. And that's simply not our economy or our state any longer. And we have a state government that really requires full-time management. And the legislator can't do that either.
In a phenomenally larger budget than
a phenomenally larger budget, local. But they also, in say a 60 or 90 day session, there's something like two or three thousand bills that are introduced. No legislator can keep on top of all those, even with the committee structure and all the rest of it. It's just impossible, and it frequently takes many years for essential legislation to get passed if it doesn't come from a legislator, but it is brought to their attention by an outside interest.
Okay.
Unless it's Boeing, in which case it takes 3 days.
Yeah, it's weird how that works. All right, let's move on to national. We only got 15 minutes left, starting out with the passing of Elijah Cummings this week.
Yeah, and it did get a lot of attention in national media, and rightfully so. Elijah Cummings, in addition to being the chair of the House Oversight Committee, that's been really central in the impeachment investigation, but he has a long history of civil rights advocacy and really good work in the House, and he's going to leave a void on that oversight committee that's going to be hard to fill. It was really sad to see his passing. And he was literally signing off as chairman of that committee on subpoenas for administration officials from his hospice bed the day before he died. So he was active right up until the end.
Yeah. All right. Well, things have been very busy this week over in D.C.
Yeah, and I don't have a lot of time to sort it all out, but we had several key testimonies in the House and in the Intelligence Committee, which is running point right now on the impeachment investigation. A lot of that was thrown into chaos by acting Chief of Staff Nick Mulvaney's casual confession that, yes, of course there was a quid pro quo involved in withholding military aid, $400 million, to Ukraine, unless Ukraine agreed to investigate Joe Biden. We do this all the time. What's wrong with it? That, of course, directly contradicted the talking points coming out of Donald Trump, who was saying there was no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo. I can't say it as quickly as you can say what was his key phrase for years around?
I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. It's all running together, isn't it?
Speaking of fake news.
Yeah. But Mulvaney is another exhibit in the impeachment inquiry at this point, proving that Donald Trump betrayed his oath of office and jeopardized national security by trying to trade military aid for personal political favor. That's an article of impeachment right there. And he's admitted to it, and now Mulvaney has confirmed it. So, what else are they waiting for? Well, the problem is, of course, that with this impeachment inquiry, Trump continues to commit impeachable offenses every week. So, where do you draw the line in terms of what you add to potential articles of impeachment? That's something the Democrats are going to have to figure out. The testimony this week, Fiona Hill mentioned a White House meeting in July with two senior Turkish officials, where Gordon Sondland, who also testified this week, he's the ambassador to the European Union, and our local guy Made Good owns the Roosevelt Hotel downtown,
I thought it was Theodore.
Theodore, I'm sorry, it changed its name a couple years ago.
Okay.
It's now.
He owns a second one too, and I can't remember what the name of that one is.
Yeah, but the Theodore is at 7th and Pine for anybody who's interested in not patronizing them. Or taking a picture in front of it and sending it to all your friends. He basically got his ambassadorship by donating $1 million to Trump's inauguration slush fund. Still hasn't been accounted for because they didn't spend nearly as much as they raised. A fraction of what they raised. It was a much smaller inauguration than is typical. Maybe that's why Trump was insisting that it was bigger than Obama's. There's been years of this stuff now, hasn't there? But he was saying that a White House visit by Erdogan was conditional on the Biden investigation. And then John Bolton, who was chairing that meeting, abruptly ended it. So they moved to the basement of the White House, where the discussion between Sondland and the Turkish officials, which was overheard by Hill, she was dispatched down there by Bolton. The discussion there was regarding Burisma, which is the Ukrainian natural gas company that Hunter Biden was on the board of, and investigating them potentially. George Kent testified this week that Giuliani has been lobbying Trump for years for the release, both the release of a Turkish-Iranian gold trader who is currently indicted for money laundering, among other things, and extradition of the cleric Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania, has a green card residency in the United States, and is blamed by Erdogan for an attempted coup a number of years ago. It really raises the question of whether Rudy Giuliani has been operating as a Turkish agent, which, if you remember, that's what Michael Flynn got in trouble for as the National Security Advisor. He was on the Turkish government payroll. So is Giuliani representing Turkey? Is he representing Donald Trump? Is there any difference? That seems to be another major question in this whole mess. Sondland also testified this week, and he pleaded ignorance of any quid pro quo and said that it was all up to Rudy Giuliani. So he's trying to throw Giuliani under the bus. And we also found out this week that the Southern District of New York, in addition to arresting four of Giuliani's quote-unquote associates last week is actively investigating Giuliani himself for a number of potential violations of law. And that's ironic, of course, because Giuliani once ran the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office. So meanwhile, one of those four associates, a guy named Parnas, turns out to be mob connected. He's had dinners with Trump at the White House. He attended H.W. Bush's funeral with Giuliani. And in 2008, he received a restraining order in South Florida from an owner of the property that he was renting after having threatened his life and then held a gun to his head, apparently. So
he did that to the owner of that property?
Yes.
Okay.
This is a savory character for sure. we found out in a court hearing for all four of them later this week that U.S. prosecutors were saying that the discovery process would be, quote, fairly voluminous, including about 10 email accounts and 50 bank accounts between these four people. So something fishy is going on. And it also involves Trump's main super PAC called America First that these guys were supposedly funneling foreign donations into, particularly Russian money and donations. And a lot of this goes back to a Ukrainian oligarch who's very closely connected to Vladimir Putin named Firtash. He's become a billionaire because he was basically set up as the middleman for Russian natural gas going through Ukraine. He got a cut of every natural gas passage through Ukraine as a middleman and has become a billionaire that way. He's currently holed up in Vienna fighting extradition to the United States on corruption charges. He apparently has hired Rudy Giuliani as his representative, his legal representative, one of Giuliani's associates.
And I was going to say, who the heck would hire Giuliani at this point?
Yeah, a lot of these guys seem to. His previous lawyer, incidentally, was Lanny Davis, and that didn't work in terms of sucking up to Trump once Davis also represented Michael Cohen, Trump's previous personal attorney who got into a lot of legal trouble. I would be very leery of if I were an attorney of becoming Donald Trump's private attorney once Giuliani is taken out of the picture, which I think is going to happen pretty soon. The lawyers he hired were Fox News lawyers closely connected to Giuliani. He also hired Giuliani's associates that were arrested this past week to dig up dirt on Biden, which explains why Rudy Giuliani was on Fox News a couple of months ago waving a sheet of paper saying he had the conclusive proof that Biden was corrupt. That information came from Firtash via the Giuliani associates, and it's basically right-wing conspiracy theories. There's nothing there, but Firtash got it from somewhere, probably from the Kremlin, which is feeding a lot of this information into the system. Bloomberg is saying that dirt on Biden was to be traded for extradition. In other words, intervening so Firtash could avoid extradition to the United States. And Rudy Giuliani was paid $500,000 by Parnas, one of his quote-unquote associates. That money almost certainly came from Firtash. And in January, Giuliani tried to get a visa for the corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor that Joe Biden was and all of the United States and the United States' allies were trying to get removed at the time for corruption. That guy is also connected with Firtash, and Giuliani tried to get a visa for him to the United States. The State Department rejected it, and then he tried and failed, Giuliani did, to get the White House to overrule the State Department. So it really does, a lot of this goes back to Firtash, and it really does raise the question of who exactly Giuliani is working for. Is he working for the Turkish government? Is he working for a Ukrainian oligarch? Is he working for Donald Trump? And do all three of their interests coincide?
check all boxes that apply.
Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, we had another cabinet resignation this week. Rick Perry, the Energy Secretary, finally resigned after rumors have been going around for weeks. He's also implicated in the Ukrainian gas company Burisma, the attempted putsch thereof. One of the other things on the side that Giuliani's associates were trying to do was get the leadership of that natural gas company replaced with people who are more friendly to the Kremlin and obviously more friendly to Trump as well, and potentially try and gin up more fake evidence against the Bidens. That really does seem to connect all of this. And then we had buried in all of this news that happened on Thursday, something that didn't get a lot of attention in American media. The Russian state media announced a joint U.S.-Russian work on cybersecurity. You may remember when Trump embarrassed himself in Helsinki by fellating Vladimir Putin at every chance, that Trump threw out the idea that, yeah, it'd be great if Russia could help us investigate what happened in 2016 and get to the bottom of this. This all goes back to trying to pin 2016 election interference on Ukraine rather than the United States. That would, if that's the official United States position, that would enable Russia to go to Congress and try and get the sanctions lifted, which is something that they wanted since the very first day of the Trump presidency. You can remember that was something that Flynn was very active in trying to make happen during his three-week tenure as National Security Advisor before he had to resign. This is something that hasn't gone away either. So all of these roads seem to lead back to Russia or Russian-connected oligarchs. It all becomes one big, messy, sprawling story. And again, if you're the Democrats and the Intelligence Committee, are you trying to focus on the July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky and President Trump, or do you try and untangle this much larger mess that all seems to be connected and is connected not only to the 2016 election, but also active Russian interference in the 2020 election?
All right. And also this week, Trump awarded himself the contract for the G7.
Yeah, this is another potential argument of impeachment, because it's a clear violation of the emoluments clause. Trump awarded himself an enormously lucrative federal contract, namely getting the next G7 to be held at his own property in South Florida. Doral, which has been notoriously underperforming in the Trump organization's own admission for years and has serious problems with bed bugs, among other things. There's legal proceedings involving that. This contract involves 50 to 100 days of advance teams for all of these foreign leaders who would be coming to the area, and they would all be staying at Doral for that time. Despite the White House claims that Donald Trump will be getting no profit from this, obviously there was enormous profit at a time in South Florida in June when it's hot and sticky and not tourist season, and it's the slowest time of year for resorts in that area. So incidentally, in terms of the awarding of the contract, usually for something like a G7, there's a lot of the White House was claiming that they reviewed 12 sites and Doral was the best. The mayor of the city of Doral, in which Trump's resort is located, says that he's heard nothing from the federal government about what the city would need to do to accommodate that kind of security apparatus and all those folks coming into the area. And obviously, local governments would have to be involved in that as well. But he's heard nothing. Trump just awarded himself the contract, and they'll sort it out later.
All right. Well, we're going to have to – we're running behind time. We're going to have to jump to events.
Okay. I do want to flag not only the CYA diplomacy, quote-unquote, ceasefire in Syria, which really green-lighted ethnic cleansing in a similar way that Trump's phone call with Erdogan a couple of weeks ago green-lighted the Turkish invasion. But check out Trump's bizarrely childish letter to Erdogan. It reads like one of his tweets, only worse. And of course, Brexit, as of this morning, is in chaos once again. And there have been huge protests in Barcelona and Chile and Hong Kong continuing. Check those stories all out. Events coming up. On Tuesday, the 22nd of October, Seattle City Council is having its second budget hearing. That'll be at Council Chambers at City Hall, 5th and James, from 5 to 9:30 in the evening. So if you have input on Mayor Durkin's proposed budget and its priorities and what council ought to change, please do attend that. Also, on the evening of the 22nd, our good friend David Persamian is in town, the host of Alternative Radio. He's talking about his new book, Rise and Resist, Activism in the Age of Trump. That will be at Town Hall. It's $5 as usual. It's at 8th and Seneca, just outside downtown. And then on Thursday, the 24th of October, from noon to 12:45 p.m., Don't let Bezos buy this election. It's a rally by Amazon and other tech workers are organizing it along with their allies that will be at the Spheres, 7th and Lenora in downtown Seattle during lunch hour.
All right. Who could imagine that we would be talking about some place called the Spheres, the new permanent spot for events in Seattle. All right. So we'll plan on seeing you next week.
Yes. And hopefully Maria as well.
Our fingers are crossed.